prophet saying, all the psukim from Sefer Shmos. So why didn't Chazal just opt for the parashios in the first half of Sefer Shmos, which have a much more elaborate account of the Sikur Yetzias Mitzrayim, rather than, again, this highly compressed account? And the Rebbe answered, no, he had a senes, that the mitzvah of Sikur Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Leil HaSeder, is a mitzvah, is a night of Masorah, of the Yigarta Levimcha. And it's Pedavka, because of the need for Torah Shebal Peh, in order to be able to understand and appreciate the Pesukim and Parshas Harameh of Avi, so for that reason, Gufa, what seems to us to be maybe a handicap, a drawback, no, that is its advantage. It's to highlight the need and the place of Masorah in our lives. That's what the mitzvah of Sikur Yetzias Mitzrayim is. It is a mitzvah of Masorah. It's a mitzvah of conveying, of transmitting, of transferring. And to highlight that fact, Chazal said that we should bedafka operate with the parasha of Harameh Ovid Ovi, where we're so dependent upon the Torah Shebal Peh, upon the Masorah, to be able to be yodet la'omkam shel dvarim. I wanted, with your leave, with your indulgence, to initially read together, just to read aloud. I hope most, if not all of you, have it in front of you. If you don't have it in front of you, it's a good time to make friends with the guy sitting to your right or your left, and have access to it. To read a page or so from Isha Halacha, where it all talks about what the halachic substance of mitzvah Sibur Yetzias Mitzrayim is, and then perhaps to try to, albeit superficially, try to get a little bit of a handle on the fundamental idea and ideas that the Rav teaches here. So on page 117, under the Roman numeral 4. The experience of halachic man is not circumscribed by his own individual past, but transcends this limited realm and enters the domain of eternity. It's much better in the original Lashon HaKodesh. The Jewish people's all-embracing collective consciousness of time, the sages of the tradition, the Second Temple era, the age of classical prophecy, the revelation on Mount Sinai, the exodus from Egypt, the lives of the patriarchs, the creation itself, is an integral part of the I awareness of halachic man. His time is measured by the standard of our Torah, which begins with the creation of heaven and earth. Similarly, halachic man's future does not terminate with the end of his own individual future at the moment of death, but extends into the future of the people as a whole. The people who yearn for the coming of the Mashiach, and Malch HaShakai, the kingdom of God. The splendor of antiquity and the brilliance of, here the original Lashon HaKodesh is not only more beautiful but also more intelligible, of Achdus HaYomim, envelop halachic man's time consciousness. We have here a blurring of the boundaries dividing time from eternity, temporal life from everlasting life. Skipping around four lines. On the contrary, everlasting life only reveals itself through the medium of the experience of time. The hour is transformed into infinity, the moment into eternity. Man can glimpse eternity only through the consciousness of time. The whole thrust of the various commandments of remembrance set forth in the Torah, for example, the remembrance of the Exodus, the remembrance, according to Ramban, of the revelation at Mount Sinai, the remembrance of Shabbos, the remembrance of Amalek, is directed toward the integration of these ancient events into man's time consciousness. The exodus from Egypt, the divine revelation on Mount Sinai, the creation of the world, all are transformed into an integral part of the content of man's present consciousness, into a powerful direct experience. The command to relate the story of the Exodus carries with it a unique halacha. But how can a person regard himself as one of those who left Mitzrayim as a companion of Moshe and Aharon in the remote dawn of our history, if not by including himself in this ancient past and in the process of redemption that occurred then? If we have time, so then maybe Blineda will come back to, or will return to the rest of the passage, where the Rav talks about how the future enters into the Isha Halacha's consciousness. So what did we just read here? So let's try, maybe with the help of the one or two mashalim, to try to get a little bit of an understanding, a little bit of a handle. Let's say you have two people. One person is standing inside, let's say in such a room. No windows? No access to the outside world. And he turns on the radio, and he hears a weather report that right now it's raining on Trehune Avenue, CBS 880. Craig Allen, it's raining on Trehune Avenue in Passaic, New Jersey. Someone else is standing outside, and he's feeling and seeing, and if it's a thunderstorm, hearing the downpour. So what's the difference between those two people in terms of their knowledge, their handle on what's happening? The first individual, so his knowledge is impersonal, non-experiential. It's derived. It's derivative. Entirely logical. It's entirely reasonable to accept the weatherman's account of what's happening right now. Not sure that I want to endorse what they say about what's going to happen in a few hours from now or what's going to happen tomorrow. But in terms of the meteorologist's report of what's happening right now, it's very, again, very reasonable, very logical. But at the end of the day, the knowledge is one step removed. It's impersonal, non-experiential, it's derivative, cliché-y. The second case, the one who's standing outside in the downpour. So for him, his knowledge is immediate and personal and experiential. He feels, sees, and possibly even hears the downpour. Now, to try to come a step closer to the tremendous and so fundamental idea and the aspect of perspective on Masora that the Rav provides. Imagine a different Masora Bosai. Imagine you have a Holocaust survivor. And the Holocaust survivor is accosted by one of these Rishonim, a Holocaust denier. Holocaust denial has got nothing to do with skepticism about historical truth. It's pure and unadulterated. It's nothing other than that. So imagine that a Holocaust survivor is accosted by one such Russian. And he says to him, "You claim to be a rational individual, and you claim that whatever beliefs you maintain are rationally grounded. So prove to me, show me the historical evidence and documentation that the Holocaust occurred." Otherwise, if you can't do that, if you can't quote me, if you can't provide me with that historical documentation, so then that means that your beliefs are irrational, it means that you just make a leap of faith and you believe whatever you want to believe. Where's the historical record? Now, obviously, that there couldn't be a more absurd challenge, a more ludicrous claim or argument than that. The Holocaust survivor, he was there in Auschwitz. He was part of a selectia. He saw the Kedoshim march to the gas chambers. He saw their bodies carried out to the crematoria. He has a number forever in this earthly existence engraved upon his arm. He experienced the Holocaust. He doesn't need evidence to support inferences or derivations, because he possesses immediate first-hand knowledge. Lu Yitzuyar, this isn't true obviously, contrapositive, conditional, but Lu Yitzuyar, that all historical records of the Holocaust would disappear, it wouldn't affect the survivor's knowledge an iota. What's more, his knowledge is incomparably superior to that of the Holocaust historian born after the war, who didn't experience the Holocaust firsthand. He may have very, very nobly and helpfully, importantly, dedicated his life to amassing historical evidence and incontrovertible proof. But at the end of the day, the historian knows by deduction, by inference, the survivor experienced. So let's try to take the moshel a step further, I will say. Imagine that the gauntlet is thrown down similarly, that a similar challenge is posed to children of a Holocaust survivor. They weren't physically in the camps, they weren't part of the selection, they weren't physically present when they saw family, friends march to the gas chambers. But they grew up in a home that was saturated, permeated with those memories. Their father, in fulfillment of a modern-day application of Zachar Eis Asher Asa Lecha Amalek, would tell them about what he had witnessed and what he experienced. So how would you classify the knowledge that the children have? It's the knowledge of the person listening to the radio here in this room without windows, doesn't know what's going on outside, but he hears. He hears the meteorologist on the radio saying that it's raining outside. Or is there something more? At a certain point, the father's memories are transferred. And there's a merging of the consciousness of father and child. The memory bank, what's deposited in the memory bank of the parent, is transferred to the memory bank of the child. It's not that impersonal, deductive knowledge based on inference, but it has that same reality and vividness of one's own experience, and the same authenticity, and the same compelling epistemological status. Everyone here, I think, can give similar examples from their own experiences. Think of stories that you heard from your parents, but stories that loomed very prominent in your parents' life experiences. I used to hear very often that the year after the Hakamas HaMedina, my father, Zichrono Livracha, traveled to Eretz Yisrael by boat. It wasn't as... When I go to Eretz Yisrael, I'm very impressed with the Ma'ariv Mesilas Nefesh, the lack of legroom in the economy, and tolerating the inevitable delays and arriving 45 minutes late, always schedules my flights to depart 2 to 3 hours late, and I feel tremendous Mesiris Nefesh. When my father, who had such tremendous Chibas Eretz Yisrael, went to Eretz Yisrael the year after Hakamas HaMedina, he went by boat. It was a 10 to 14 day trip. And one of the memories that he used to, and because of his Chibas Eretz Yisrael, it was a memory that he often shared. And one of the experiences he had that year when he was in Eretz Yisrael, again, it was something that was made such an impression upon him that he naturally would return and share that memory over the years on many occasions. He was the night of Rosh Hashanah by our cousin, the Rav Mistrivka Rebbe. If I'm not making a mistake in calculating the Shachshavos HaDoros, I think it was the grandfather of the current Rebbe in Bauer Park, the great-grandfather of the current Rav Mistrivka Rebbe in Yerushalayim. At that point, I think it was shortly after the Petira of the Yemei Emes, so the Geri Rebbe was then the Beis Yisrael. Beis Yisrael was significantly younger than the Rav Mistrivka Rebbe. So he was coming, the night of Rosh Hashanah, to wish a good yore to Rav Mistrivka Rebbe. As the Rebbe gay and al Hasidim. Beis Yisrael didn't really have the luxury of just going out by himself for a little walk on Rosh Hashanah. So my father used to describe how he was sitting with the Rav Mistrivka Rebbe, and all of a sudden the house began to shake. Literally, it was shaking in its foundations. What was it? The Beis Yisrael was coming to wish a good yore, followed by, accompanied by countless Hasidim, many, many more than the fire department would have approved of. And the house was literally shaking. That memory is a part of my consciousness. It's not comparable to when I hear the meteorologist telling me that it's raining in the Passaic or what the temperature is in Newark. Well, that's something which is secondhand, that's something which is impersonal. And you could get me perhaps, maybe even to question that. Maybe under certain circumstances I could begin to wonder about the authenticity. There's nothing possible that could shake my knowledge of that journey to Eretz Yisrael in 1949 that my father took, of that experience of sitting with Rav Mistrivka Rebbe when the Beis Yisrael was coming to wish a good year. But let's perhaps reread a few of the lines here. The experience, again, going back to what really began here on 117, under the Roman numeral 4, the experience of halachic man is not circumscribed by his own individual past, but transcends this limited realm and enters the domain of eternity. The Jewish people's all-embracing collective consciousness of time the sages of the tradition, the Second Temple era, the age of classical prophecy, the revelation on Mount Sinai, the exodus from Egypt, the lives of the patriarch, the creation itself is an integral part of the eye awareness of the halachic man. Right? That's the idea that we were trying to a little bit understand. Just turning the page to 118 of those times. You see the sentence, the whole thrust, it's around 10 lines down, maybe a dozen lines down. The whole thrust of the various mitzvahs of Zechira set forth in the Torah. Zechira Yitzias Mitzrayim, Ma'amad Har Sinai, according to the Ramban, Shabbos, Maisa Amalek, is directed toward the integration of these ancient events into man's time consciousness. It's not a report that a person reads, and because of that feels he has some second, third, or fourth hand knowledge of the event, but it's something that's integrated into his consciousness. Yitzias Mitzrayim, Ma'amad Har Sinai, Briyas HaOlam, all are transformed into an integral part of the content of man's present consciousness, into a powerful direct experience. The mitzvah Sibur Yitzias Mitzrayim carries with it a unique halacha v'chol dov v'dov chayv odom liras atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzo mi Mitzrayim. But how can a person regard himself as one of those who left Mitzrayim as a companion of Moshe and Aaron in the remote dawn of our history, if not by including himself in this ancient past and in the process of redemption that occurred then? Just a word, one more word of elaboration. The appeal to Masorah as a source of knowledge and a source of truth is of course one that is classically, has been classically presented throughout the Doros. Generally, conventionally, that invoking of Masorah as a source of truth is understood as derivative knowledge, second, third, fourth, fifth-hand knowledge, conclusions which we arrive at based on reliable transmission. Reliable reports. The Rav's toward the force, the tremendous, tremendous insight, which totally, totally changes, transforms one's understanding of the concept of Masorah, the experience of Masorah, the mitzvah, Sipur, Zechir Yitzias Mitzrayim, is that what the Torah allows for, what the mitzvahs are designed to accomplish, is this merging of historical consciousness with one's own personal consciousness. And the same way, every one of us in this room, again, the Rav always used to apologize for drawing upon his own experiences. And used to say, not that I think my experiences are any more valid or any more important than anyone else's, but I have no one else's experiences to draw upon. So, many hamdallahs. So the examples I gave are intended the same way. You all have your own examples of memories of your parents, of your grandparents, which are your own memories, where there's been a transfer made from the memory bank of parents or grandparents to children and grandchildren. And that knowledge isn't derivative knowledge. It's not remote, second, third, fourth-hand knowledge. It has all the authenticity and is every bit as compelling as first-hand memory, with all the vividness and equally compelling. Drifting beyond, for the moment, the mitzvahs of Sipur and Zechira, the Rav has a similar chiddush, similar epistemological chiddush, in a very different context. What I've said until now, what was oversimplified, so that's true tenfold for what we're about to try to discuss now. I hope to have the siyata d'shmaya that oversimplification and distortion will not be one and the same. Don't have in front of you, and I also don't have the translation for this. But reading you a few lines from the second section here, Likash Nevisham, we're also almost approaching overtime, so please feel free to leave. Anyone who has commitments and should please. Please feel free to leave. Lo nechachei ki yeshno hevdel mesuyam bein machshavat ha'avar lezo shel ha'hove benoge ledrishat ha'el sofiyut derech ha'metziyut ha'sofit. We won't deny that there's a distinct difference between the approach, the thought of past eras in philosophy to that of the present with regard to seeking to discover infinity via finite existence. B'sha'a shehafilosofia shel yimei ha'beinayim v'gam zo shel reshit ha'tkufa ha'chadasha bit'u In the times of ancient thought and medieval thought, so there were logical, deductive proofs put forward for Metzias Hashem. Modern thought, the Rav says, presumably alluding to Kant and those who followed him, elsewhere the Rav often quotes him by name, I'm not sure why he doesn't here. Challenge them. And question whether we really, when we perceive cause and effect, so is that something that we really understand as being something which is objective? Or maybe that's just the categories, maybe that's just the way our minds work. The way our minds systematize what we see. And when I bang on the shender, if I bang a little bit too hard, and then my hand hurts, so maybe my mind is just programmed. Maybe that's just the workings of the human mind, that we assume that temporal sequence wasn't coincidental, and we interpret what happens in terms of cause and effect. But if it's sort of, again, Moshe Lamad Ovadome, if you wear tinted glasses, let's say the blue tinted or violet tinted, so then I'll begin to wonder, what is it with this community per se that everyone wears blue shirts or wears violet shirts? When the reality is, what's with it with my glasses, that my glasses are blue tinted or violet tinted? So can you really make logical deductions from the way we analyze the world? But that was the challenge which in the history of philosophy caused tremendous upheaval. Brahm, says the Rav, Tfisa zo ba'a la'akor u'matz'a et atzma notat. This understanding, while it intended to uproot, really ended up planting. Ba'a la'akrish, it came to deny, to be agnostic, u'matz'a et atzma ma'amina. But really provided a more compelling basis and foundation for emunah. Kafra hi biyicholet ha'adam lahasig ba'akifin al yedei hochachot. It denied the ability, the capacity of man to indirectly draw conclusions through proofs, through argumentation, benot koach sheni shel ha'higayon, derivative, once removed, twice removed, logical conclusions, logical derivations. Aval bimkom limchod et kol hamoftim misifra. Read the Rav's Ksavim, you have to make a Birkas HaTorah, you also have to make a Birkas HaNen. Aval bimkom limchot et kol hamoftim misifra, but rather than erasing all these compelling demonstrations from its book, ki yamah v'kibla otam k'chavayot bilti emtzaiyot she'enan miyisadot al pu'ulot ha'hegesh ha'hegyoni. But instead, it upheld and substantiated these same arguments as being something which is unquestionable because of its intuitive, immediate nature. Let's again try to understand. Let's return to our mashal. Let's return to our mashal with the rain. Imagine you have one person who's looking at the computer model. And he sees on the computer model, he sees, the computer model looks like, oh, no one else here does either, so you can hold on to blocking this. So he sees in the computer model, he sees the formation of the clouds, and he sees the movement, and all of that tells him that it's gonna be raining in the work. He's not in the work, but when you analyze what he's seeing, there's no other way to really account for all this data, all this information, all these reports, other than to surmise that it must be raining in the work. Then you have another person. He's standing outside in the work, and he's soaking wet. And he's, as they say in not so eloquent English, it's marbling out, and he's getting drenched in the downpour. It doesn't matter whatever philosophical objections or questions one may raise with regard to the first person's chain of reasoning. So those may or may not be valid, but there's a lot to discuss. Because he is, again, working through a logical chain of inferences and or deductions. Maybe the objections are correct, maybe they're not correct. Yes, Lotan, there's what to talk about. The other person who's standing outside in the downpour in Newark, so he's not working through any logical deductions, but there's an immediate grasp, understanding, awareness, knowledge, which is unassailable, which is incontrovertible. When David HaMelech says, Baruchi Nafshi, you can understand Baruchi Nafshi as the meteorologist studying the computer models, or you can understand Baruchi Nafshi as this intuitive understanding that the Bria is not self-sustaining, as an intuitive, not a logical, analytical approach, but as an intuitive, immediate, first-hand grasp that celestial motion is not self-propelling and not self-sustaining. And then it's no more open to question than it is the person's experience who's standing outside when it's raining. It's an intuitive, immediate experience. The result, says the Rav, of the challenge to the traditional cosmological proofs was really to elevate them and make them even more compelling. Because, let's return to the Moshel, when you bang on the Shtender, it's not... In that instance, a person is not reasoning logically, but it's just an intuitive experience that causes pain. And you can't challenge that person, you can't legitimately, meaningfully, sensically, in any sensible fashion, challenge what he knows. It's not based on, again, logical inferences and chains of reasoning. It's very much the same type of approach, the same type of chiddush that the Rav presented in his discussion of Masorah and his discussion of Mitzvah Sipur and Zechira. And the truth is, the Rav himself makes this comparison. If you take a look at in one of the volumes posthumously published, it's the one entitled The Abraham's Journey. So the Rav makes this comparison. The historian will say that Avraham Avinu cannot be considered an archaeological reality, since measured by the conventional standards of historical evidence, we cannot assert as a certainty that such a person lived and acted in the way the Chumash describes. Many a Bible critic, Jew or Gentile, cast serious doubt upon the authenticity of the narrative about this strange and unique man. I'm jumping around a little bit. As a matter of fact, this sort of skepticism regarding the biblical historical account has of late lost much of its vigor and arrogance. Recent excavations and discoveries have confirmed many biblical accounts, not only in their general outlines, but more important in their minute details, such as names of geographic places, travel routes, and cultic forms. Skipping somewhat. One will think twice nowadays before denying the existence of such a person. To us, this problem is almost irrelevant. We need no evidence of the historical existence of Avraham Avinu, just as there's no necessity for clear-cut logical evidence concerning the reality of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The immediacy and aboriginal impact of our God experience, that's what we tried a little bit, very superficially, to talk about before, cutting through all levels of existence and forming the very essence of our ontic awareness, awareness of existence, does not require any other form of evidence and is not subject to logical, deductive, or inductive verification. The God experience is prior to cognitive activities of every kind, including the act of postulation. We may deal in a similar manner with the historical, open quote, proofs, close quote, of the existence of Avraham Avinu. As the architect and founder of our nation, Avraham Avinu has left such an indelible imprint upon our unfolding historic destiny that he's been integrated into our historical consciousness. I did catch the end of Sachs's remarks. And he was entirely correct in the depiction, the positioning from a historical perspective of the Rav. That when you talk about the Rav, so if you're talking about in Halacha, you're talking about Reb Chaim, you're talking about Reb Chaim Eger, you're talking about the Rav, that's the class in which he belongs. What perhaps is equally or more underappreciated is that when you talk about Machshava, you talk about deep, profound Jewish philosophy, grappling, illuminating the most fundamental issues, you talk about Rav Sadia Gaon, you talk about the Rambam, you talk about Rav Yehuda Halevi, and you talk about Rav Soloveitchik. The next comment, you'll forgive me for the comment, it certainly doesn't refer to Rav Sachs in any fashion. But the only, that there is an irony about this, obviously, coming on the heels of the discussion of Masorah, and that irony is that doesn't escape me. Oral history regarding the Rav is very, very unreliable. It was unreliable in his lifetime. When we stand 25 years afterwards. My mother, Tzolanga Yoram, once asked him why he didn't deny all the false things said in his name, all the distortions, all the ludicrous fabrications. And he told her, if I'm going to start denying things that are said in my name, I'll spend my entire life, Pshutukim Hashmo, issuing denials. There were similar comments made by Eber Gedol Yisrael. Shlomo Zalman Oyevach told the people close to him, if you didn't hear it from me, or you don't see it in my handwriting, don't believe it. Inaccuracies, misunderstandings, distortions arise different ways. Sometimes people honestly misunderstood. Sometimes people not so honestly heard what they wanted to hear. Sometimes people fabricated in an attempt to co-opt the Rav's towering stature and authority, tell that from Ilan Gordon. Now, honestly, yesh v'yesh, that there are certainly oral accounts that are true and that give a dimension that isn't available elsewhere. But unless a person knew him very, very well to be able to know what can be true and what couldn't be true, you can't rely on war-long reports. It's not reliable. If you want to know, and again, obviously there are exceptions, and obviously everyone should die in Nefesh HaRav and Tmimei HaRav and Nevi HaRav and enjoy and absorb and invest. And I'm not pushing off an opponent, not alluding to anything of Saxon, not alluding to him on the flood. But yesh. If you want to be exposed to who the Rav was, so as much as possible, expose yourself firsthand. In the Sefer Machshava, learn them. Not read them. Can't read them. Learn them. Get a very, very, very good, comprehensive Hebrew English dictionary. Have it at your side. Read Yishalacha. Have a Chavrusa. The same way you'd have a Chavrusa in Shef Schweitzer. In the Nora. Have a Chavrusa. Learn Yishalacha. Learn Uvikashtam Yishon. Learn some of the posthumously published English volumes. Those were lightly edited, but once you get used to the Rav's Lashon, you can tell where and how they were edited and what's verbatim. Learn the Chidushei Hagram VaHagrid. Learn the Kavitz Chidushei Torah. Learn all the Divrei Torah firsthand. Firsthand, you'll see. This is someone who was he? He stood alongside Reb Chaim. He stood alongside Reb Akiva Egyo when you learn the Chidushei Torah. Who was he in the world of philosophy and the Jewish thought? As one Adam Gadol, contemporary Adam Gadol, said to me, an Adam Gadol who's positioned to have a perspective, the last Jewish philosopher. But in the ranks, in the annals of Mamish, the Gedolei HaMasor, the Gedolei Chachmim, Yimei HaBeinayim. Baruch Hashem, what's available firsthand, the truth is, doesn't begin to capture who he was, what he was, but it's enough. It's enough to know that who he was or what he was something very, very unique, the likes of which none of us, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, are likely to ever see again in their lifetimes. Thank you.